Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'm delighted now to welcome Charles McKay. He's the general director of the Santa Fe Opera, and we're talking just 8 days before the opening night of the Santa Fe Opera. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So, general director, what do you do? Everything.
That covers a multitude of responsibilities, and most of them are very, very pleasant, I must say. Occasionally you get into a little bit of a sticky situation, but it's a huge honor to be heading this great company, the company where I grew up, so to speak.
You actually grew up here in Santa Fe.
I grew up in Santa Fe, attended my first youth opera performance at age nine.
Did you love it?
I fell in love with opera instantly. I was so smitten with this art form. And to me, that really says so much about the power that opera can have for kids. It is really a magical experience. And my recollection of the experience is, first and foremost, the excitement and thrill of hearing the live orchestra. Then watching the stage come to life with scenery and costumes and lighting. It was pure magic, and hearing these beautiful voices that were unamplified soaring over the orchestra in this indescribably beautiful setting of the Santa Fe Opera, looking out on the Jemez Mountains. It was a great experience. I saw Die Fledermaus as my first opera.
You remember that first one?
Absolutely. And I pestered my parents to get me a recording of Die Fledermaus, and they found a recording of highlights of Die Fledermaus from the Vienna Volksoper. And I think I played that on my little portable record player over and over and over again. It must have driven my parents to distraction.
Were they opera people?
They were opera lovers, and actually were both very fine singers. And in a different day and age, they would have been in a young artist program, possibly even the Santa Fe Opera's apprentice program, which really is the flagship training program for singers in this country. And so I grew up hearing a lot of opera, hearing a lot of music, hearing music sung and played at home by my parents. And so I took to it very, very naturally.
Now, you were also a musician. You played the French horn. Did you want to sing?
Do you know, I was always, I think because my parents were singers, I wanted to go in a slightly different direction. You know how kids are. And I was drawn to the sound of the French horn. Very, very beautiful instrument, a difficult instrument. And I was determined that I was going to be a French horn player in an orchestra, and specifically, I wanted to play in an opera orchestra, not necessarily in a symphony orchestra, but an opera orchestra, because I loved opera, and I thought it would be really neat to be in the orchestra pit and accompanying the singers and playing that great music. So lo and behold, I was so determined about this, I actually managed to land a position in the Santa Fe Opera Orchestra when I was 17 years old. I was an extra player at that point, the first season, playing offstage orchestra in Der Rosenkavalier. And that was the opening of the rebuilt theater in 1968 after the fire. And I can remember it so vividly because I think resources were a bit scarce at that point for the opera company, and there was no set for Der Rosenkavalier. It was simply sumptuous costumes and beautiful props and furniture, but no set. And I think that was my first awareness of kind of the economic aspects of opera. And that was a great experience for a young person to have seen an opera as a kid, and then, you know, basically 10 years, or not even 10 years later, right, to be playing in the orchestra.
What it sounds like is, oh, you fulfilled your childhood career ambition by the time you were 17. Where did you go from there?
I played in the orchestra for a number of seasons and graduated to the orchestra pit itself. But I should back up a little bit. When I was playing the extra horn part in Der Rosenkavalier, my real title was orchestra assistant. And that entailed putting out the music on the stands, arranging the seats in the orchestra pit, holding the door for the conductor when the conductor was making his entrance onto the podium. And I was affectionately known in the company as the pit boy, not orchestra assistant. And I think the second or third summer that I was there, and I was studying by this time with the man who was the principal horn player in the Santa Fe Opera Orchestra, Robert Elworthy, and he taught at the University of Minnesota, and I, you know, was totally, totally absorbed with playing this wonderful instrument. And the third summer, one of the principal horn players in the orchestra developed a bleeding ulcer and had to drop out, so I replaced him for the season. And that was a great experience for me. I played in Flying Dutchman when Ado de Waart made his American debut, which was a very exciting event and occasion for me. But gradually I got sidetracked into the administrative side of opera almost by accident, because one day Ben Saiz, who was the controller of the opera back then and still is today, came by and said, the bookkeeper quit. And we need somebody who can kind of help out in the meantime. And I said, well, I've taken a few accounting courses, so maybe I can just, you know, kind of fake it for a short period while you look for somebody else who can do it on a more permanent basis. Before you knew it, I was splitting my time between the business office and the orchestra pit. And I think at the end of that season, I screwed up my courage and went to Mr. Crosby and said, I know I said I wanted to be a French horn player in an opera orchestra more than anything, but now I'm really intrigued by what makes the opera company run. How does it function from an administrative standpoint? And I asked his advice, what should I do in order to learn about opera management? And he said, he looked me in the eye and said, report for work on Monday morning at 9 a.m. I have a job for you. And my first job was administrative assistant and fund drive clerk. And so over a period of about 10 years when I worked for the opera at that point, I went from being administrative assistant and fund drive clerk to being business manager. And so that sort of takes us to 1979, when I took off and went to the Spoleto Festival and later on to Opera Theater of St. Louis to succeed Richard Gaddis for the first time in my career.
And now the second time. Here you are at the Santa Fe Opera.
That's right. I swore I would never follow Richard Gaddis again.
Why?
He's a very tough act to follow. He is such an amazing impresario, fundraiser, administrator, I've learned so much from Richard over the years. And of course, we worked together at the Santa Fe Opera back in my previous life here.
Right.
And you know, I think I the combination of having John Crosby and Richard Gaddis as my principal mentors was you know, just an incredible opportunity for me.
Now, let's talk about that a little more. How do you see their tradition, their legacy? What did they do? How did they do it? And how are you following in their footsteps and maybe departing as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, John was the great visionary who had the idea to establish an opera company in Santa Fe, New Mexico, And, you know, on the side of a mountain, to create a festival season that utilized the talents of the most gifted young American singers, working with fine directors, designers, conductors. And from the very beginning, having a really diverse repertory. When you look at the early days of the Santa Fe Opera, the premieres of Stravinsky, Hindemith, and other important composers, Carlisle Floyd did a world premiere, I think, the second season, Wuthering Heights, Marvin David Levy, another early world premiere for the Santa Fe Opera. So John Crosby really put the stamp on this company of its identity in terms of repertory, its place in the American opera scene. And at that point, there were very, very few other summer festivals. Richard Gaddis, of course, came to the company in 1969, and in many ways, he was the front man for the Santa Fe Opera because he is so gifted in terms of public relations, dealing with donors and contributors and artists and all the different personalities involved in an opera company. And I think John really relied on him in that respect because John was a very shy person. He was absolutely brilliant, but dealing with people was not necessarily his strongest suit. He was a brilliant man, a gifted conductor, conducted probably one or two productions every season during his tenure. And so the combination of having those two mentors, observing them, being able to pick up on some of their traits and characteristics, how they approached running the opera company, it was very, very important for me. Of course, when I succeeded Richard in St. Louis, I had an opportunity to sort of go to the masterclass level, if you will, in terms of following his fine example in terms of building the company up from just a startup opera company in the late 70s to being another important summer opera festival. And there's always been a very, close connection between the two companies, Santa Fe Opera and Opera Theater of St. Louis. In many ways, Richard said that the Opera Theater of St. Louis was a perfect place for the apprentices, the finest apprentices from the Santa Fe Opera, to then take on leading roles and to develop their craft in a smaller setting, and then ideally to return to the Santa Fe Opera in leading roles.
Interesting.
And that tradition has very much continued. You look at some of the early stars, Vincent Cole, Ashley Putnam, Sherry Greenewald, who appeared in St. Louis early on, then came to Santa Fe. And more recently, Christine Brewer did many of her earliest appearances at Opera Theater of St. Louis and then graduated to the larger stage, more international setting at the Santa Fe Opera. And so I think, the other similarity between the two organizations is the repertory system. There aren't many companies performing four or five operas in repertory. That means that on a given week during the season, you could see as many as five different operas. That it's complicated because you have to be rehearsing and building all the scenery and costumes for the five productions at once, and so that becomes very, very labor intensive.
And space intensive.
Yes, because you have to have all these different rehearsal facilities in order to accommodate the different operas, and private coachings and orchestra reading sessions and so forth. And it becomes a real job of coordinating the schedule from a technical point of view in terms of having lighting rehearsal sessions and making sure that you've rehearsed all the scenery shifts and that kind of thing. So there are a lot of practical elements to producing opera that most of the audience don't, they shouldn't be aware of it. But if a production is well done, it should be effortless from the viewpoint of the audience. But there are probably hundreds of people who are involved behind the scenes who really make that production happen and get it to the place where it is, you know, ready to go. So at this moment, we are in the final countdown for the season, and things are very intense around the opera. But to me, one of the greatest joys of being back at the Santa Fe Opera is to walk out into the beautiful grounds of the Opera Ranch and to hear singing coming from every quarter of the campus, so to speak. And it's sort of fun to walk along the pathway and to identify, oh yes, there's Traviata there, hear a little bit of Marriage of Figaro, I might hear some Don Giovanni. The apprentice singers are rehearsing their scenes and having coaching sessions with teachers and so forth. So it's a wonderful environment when you bring all of these creative people together for an intensive period, and it's just like sparks flying, because, you know, I think also having artists of the stature of Nathalie Dessay, Patricia Rosette, Christine Brewer, it raises everybody up
right
several notches.
Let's we're talking, by the way, to Charles McKay, General Director of the Santa Fe Opera. Let's talk about those three. As you said, for example, Christine Brewer has a real history with the Santa Fe Opera.
Absolutely. I believe she made her debut singing Ariadne, which is one of her signature roles of Strauss. And she was last in Santa Fe to sing Peter Grimes, the role of Ellen Orford. Christine is one of the most celebrated and acclaimed dramatic sopranos before the public today. She specializes in the heavier roles, Wagner and Strauss, and has one of the most beautiful instruments you could ever hear in the world of opera, and frankly in the history of opera. It is a spectacular instrument, and she is such a gifted artist in terms of her interpretive ability. Christine has been looking forward to singing the role of Alceste for a long time. This is Gluck's beautiful opera, which is not performed very often. I think the last performances of Alceste in the U.S. were in the early 90s at the Lyric Opera of Chicago with Jesse Norman. But the role is associated with some of the greatest dramatic sopranos in history. Eileen Farrell, Kirsten Flagstad, Maria Callas sang this role. It's a perfect fit for Christine Brewer. And a very important opera, by the way, because Gluck's opera is really revolutionary in the sense that it was a real departure from what the composer Gluck viewed as the excesses of a lot of Baroque opera, when the emphasis was on the performer and their ability to show off in terms of their technical skill in singing lots of scales and arpeggios and what have you. And this piece was really intended to take opera back to its kind of original intent of being the powerful combination of words, music, drama, and telling a story, and not having the emphasis on the performer. So it's a very, very beautiful piece. This is the first time it's been performed by the Santa Fe Opera, of course. And the cast also features Paul Groves, an outstanding tenor with an international reputation, directed by Francisco Negrin, a wonderful director from Barcelona. and conducted by Ken Montgomery. We're, of course, gearing up for opening night next week with the magnificent Nathalie Dessay singing her first Violetta in Traviata. And, of course, this is kind of a landmark role for many sopranos.
Right.
And
Desiree Mays and I are going to talk about that this coming Monday.
Good.
And what a... It's something that you don't do, even if you're a very gifted singer, too early in your career.
That's right. In a sense, it almost requires three different voices, because the first act is very coloratura, which means, you know, having a lot of flashy notes and so forth. And in fact, I think we might even get to hear a little bit of Nathalie Dessay singing Sempre Libera from the first act.
Yes, at the end of this program today, if we're lucky.
Good, excellent. As the story unfolds and becomes more tragic, the vocal writing changes, and it's almost more of a what we call a spinto soprano by the end of the opera. But Nathalie has been longing to do this part, she will do it magnificently, and it's an opportunity for her to show her incredible interpretive gifts and ability as a singing actress. So we're very, very excited about that. A new production, an unusual take on La Traviata, an opera that many of us know well, and I think that this will be a revelation to our audiences to see Nathalie Dessay perform this part in a wonderful production by Laurent Pelly.
And I want to talk to you about the directors in a moment, and let's also talk for a second about Patricia Rosette. I mean, you have three superstars of opera women singers who are all actors and all very good actors.
Absolutely. And have spectacular voices.
Yeah.
Pat Rosette made her debut with the Santa Fe Opera singing Emmeline, the Tobias Picker opera, in 1996, I believe. And so she has an affinity for new works. This is a role that is tailor-made for her by Paul Moravec, the composer. And she's had a lot of input into the creation of the work, which is... You know, I think a great thing, because making sure that the role is singable and that it fits a particular singer, I think, bodes well for an opera.
That must be a dream for a singer. I mean, they can't talk back to Verdi or anybody else.
That's right. That's right. Well, and of course, some of the greatest Verdi roles, of course, were written for specific singers.
Right, who probably did at the time talk back.
No doubt of it. This is a wonderful collaborative adventure. The letter by Paul Moravec with the libretto by Terry Teachout. And it will be a real ensemble opera.
Right.
In that it's a tightly knit story, a very dramatic story. And, of course, many of us have seen the wonderful William Wyler film.
Yes, and Desiree and I just talked about that a few days ago, this amazing Betty Davis film.
Absolutely.
Where she plays the role that Patricia Rosette is going to play in the opera.
Yes.
Without the singing, of course.
There you are. But it's another interesting thing about this production is that the costumes are designed by Tom Ford, who is a notable Santa Fean.
Right.
And we're thrilled. This is his operatic debut.
Interesting.
And so that is another element to the production that I think brings a lot of excitement and pizzazz to the world premiere of The Letter. But having Patricia Rosette, Christine Brewer, Nathalie Dessay, is an incredible gift. In fact, I have to stop and sort of pinch myself now and then to think that I inherited this great season as my first as general director of the Santa Fe Opera.
Well, that leads to an interesting question, which is, was this season already in place? And it was just basically handed to you on a silver platter, complete with the repertory, the singers, everything?
Basically, yes. In opera, we tend to plan two, three, four, even 5 years mm-hmm. out, because in order to get the people you want, you have to book them well in advance. And so the 2009 season was already set by the time that I was announced as being Richard's successor, and I guess that would have been in November of 2008 when I was appointed. It was almost a full year before I actually began in the job. And so Richard knew that he had to have the 2009 season all planned. There were a few gaps here and there that needed to be filled in, and so I had that opportunity. Also, one of the director designer teams kind of fell apart and had to be put back together again. That was for the Elixir of Love. And I was very happy to be able to bring Stephen Lawless, a gifted British stage director, to do the production of Elixir. And that worked out very, very well. It sort of fell into place just as I was arriving on the scene. But of course, now I've been busy working on 2010, 11, 12, and even dipping my toes into 2013. But it's always an interesting and slightly scary prospect of running an opera company when you start putting things down on paper and you might hear, for example, a wonderful developing voice that you think would be very suitable for a certain role, and you don't always know for certain how that voice is going to evolve,
right.
And if it will really be the right match with the part when the actual time arrives. So it's a fascinating and wonderful part of the job to be able to plan repertory and casting and so forth. And of course, one of the great benefits of the Santa Fe Opera is that it is such an amazing drawing card just by its reputation. And singers are clamoring to come here and perform, and stage directors, designers, conductors as well. And so it's a great destination and a great credit when they can add this to their resume.
We're talking to Charles McKay, General Director of the Santa Fe Opera. When you talk about stage directors, are there directors who direct both opera and regular stage plays? And what skills do they need to go from a stage play to the opera?
Going from just staging theater to opera, of course, requires the ability to read the score, a musical score. And that is kind of step number one. I think that more and more you're seeing stage directors from the theater world wanting to get more involved in opera because it's sort of the next frontier. Jonathan Kent is a perfect example of a stage director who does both. He will be directing our production of The Letter, and he's very busy in the London theater scene and also in the opera scene in the UK and in Europe, and has done beautiful productions for the Santa Fe Opera, most recently The Marriage of Figaro last year. But he has that uncanny ability to see the dramatic potential in a musical work, in an operatic score, and to bring it to life in a new and interesting way that is still very much in tune with the composer's intent and so forth. I think that is a slight hazard in terms of bringing non-opera directors into the opera world, that sometimes there just isn't the awareness of how do you deal with a big chorus, for example, because it's very rare in a play to have you know 40 or 50 people on stage that have to be, you know, in a sense all individuals and have to be, you know, part of a bigger more cohesive dramatic endeavor. And so we're fortunate in having a spectacular lineup of stage directors this year, with Laurent Pelly doing Traviata, who is also a gifted costume designer. He's designing the costumes for Traviata, and that's kind of an unusual combination, I would say.
Yeah, I should say.
Stephen Lawless doing Elixir of Love, Chaz Rader-Schieber doing Don Giovanni, and Chaz is a young American director who actually started his career in St. Louis as one of the prop assistants way, way back, and has made a wonderful name for himself directing opera productions at Lyric Opera of Chicago, Houston Grand Opera, Washington, New York City Opera, and so forth. And we're delighted to welcome him back. Francisco Negrin, as I mentioned, the stage director for Alceste, who is from Barcelona, and then Jonathan Kent rounding out the group as the director for The Letter. But each will have a very different approach to the works that they're directing, and that's part of the excitement and vitality
right.
of the Santa Fe Opera.
It is such an interesting thing for me as a relative newcomer to opera in preparing for all of these shows that I do with Desiree on these Mondays. Sometimes I'll rent an opera that was made 25 or 30 years ago. It's on DVD. I want to get a sense of the music. And the way they were staged 25, 30 years ago is so different from now, because they weren't really casting actors at all, and they weren't casting people appropriate, age appropriate to the roles and so on.
Right.
It's a completely different medium practically.
I think the face of opera has really changed tremendously. And frankly, I think the Santa Fe Opera has had a lot to do with that.
Really?
Because going back to the early days of the Santa Fe Opera, when you would see a production of Bohème here, I remember as a kid seeing La Bohème, and it was, you know, young singers in the leading roles who were actually believable, you know, physically doing their parts. More and more this is the case with opera, but of course we can't overlook the fact that opera, you know, kind of the central element in opera is voice. And spectacular singing is, you know, what it's all about. It's what makes opera different from any other art form, that soaring sound unamplified over the orchestra, which just sends, you know, chills down your spine. That's what it should be about.
So if somebody has that soaring voice, but they don't have the other stuff, the acting ability or the ability to really move and be in a theatrical ensemble, are they still going to get the parts?
They probably will get some parts, but I think more and more those singers are veering in the direction of concert work,
mm-hmm.
of recital work, and so forth. There are some singers who are very successful going back and forth between opera and concerts and recitals and so forth. But more and more, I think singers are really learning that they have to be stage creatures as well as, you know, good singers.
And they probably get more training in conservatory in that direction than they used to.
Absolutely. And they have experience, you know, at the Santa Fe Opera. Now, with the apprentice program and the apprentice scenes, they have an opportunity to, you know, have their own moment in the sun, working with a stage director and then performing before the public. And that is so important for a young singer in gaining confidence and finding their own individuality as a performer, how they can put their own unique stamp on a role.
There are questions of traditionalism versus new interpretations in a lot of the classic operas. Where do you stand on that, and do you even really play a role in making decisions about that, given all the amazing directors and conductors and so on that you have here at the opera?
Well, the general director generally has the opportunity to have quite a bit of artistic input into the production. Number one, by selecting the stage director and having that opportunity to discuss, you know, what kind of approach do you, the stage director, intend to take with this piece? For example, looking at our season for next year with The Tales of Hoffman, which is announced as being, you know, this will be a first time at the Santa Fe Opera, and the stage director is Christopher Alden. And Christopher is an incredibly gifted stage director. He has done a lot of updated productions, very different takes on traditional operas and so forth. And when I first spoke to him, I said, we would like a production that is set in period, that would be in the time that the opera was originally written. And he said, I'm perfectly fine with that. And, you know, I think very often stage directors appreciate having that kind of input up front.
Yeah.
Sometimes you might encounter somebody who says, well, I can't do a traditional Traviata, or I can't do a traditional this, that, or the other. And you know, one has the opportunity to probe a little bit deeper and to say, what is your point of view? How do you see this piece? And, you know, it's difficult, too, because the stage director might not know exactly where they're going to end up in terms of the interpretation of the opera until they have discussed it with their designers and, you know, scenic and costume designers, and sort of collectively they've come up with a concept, which is in turn presented to the management of the opera company. Brad Woolbright, our wonderful artistic administrator, and I sit down and talk to these people along with Paul Horpidal, the director of production, and we determine, is it practical, is it affordable, is it appropriate for us, do we think this is, you know, is it also, is it a good balance with what else is in the season.
Right, right.
You know, you wouldn't want to.
That must be such
have
a wonderful time of development that in,
is,
in the season.
That is the you know, kind of the frosting on the cake, so to speak. When you get to have these conversations with the creative people, and again, as I said earlier, the sparks can really fly. But there are a lot of other sides to, you know, running an opera company, which are not necessarily in the artistic direction, but are equally important, because I think we have to have a good financial base in order to make it all work and be sustainable.
Well, not to get into that at too much length, because we don't have all that much time left, but how are you navigating that in these economic times?
Well, I'm touching wood here.
Knocking on wood.
And saying, I think, you know, we're basically doing pretty well, all things considered. Ticket sales are a little bit behind last year, but not desperately so. Contributions are a little bit behind, but when I speak to my colleagues around the country and hear their stories, I think we're really doing pretty well. So much of it depends on what happens in terms of tourism in Santa Fe this summer, and that's, you know, to some extent a big question mark. But fortunately, the Santa Fe Opera comes from such a strong place of having, you know, good management from John Crosby and Richard Gaddis, and the loyal and generous support of so many people that we entered the economic downturn in a very strong position. So that seems to be going well. But we always have to be mindful,
sure,
of, you know, the bottom line, and trying to match expenses with revenues.
Exactly. We're talking to Charles McKay, General Director of the Santa Fe Opera. So here we are at 7,000 feet. Are there oxygen tanks in the wings?
It's not unheard of. I remember when Pauline Tinsley sang Anna Bolena years ago, we did have an oxygen tank in the wings after she finished her big aria. But fortunately, people have, you know, a period of rehearsals, say 3 or 4 weeks, when they can kind of acclimate to the altitude. But it is strenuous for some singers to perform at this altitude, and it's something that we definitely do have to consider.
I've heard it said that the reason that you don't do Wagner operas is because of the altitude. It's just nobody's got the stamina. Is that true? Would you do Wagner?
Well, I think The stamina factor is certainly an important one, but length is probably even more important, because most operas by Wagner are 4 or even 5 hours long. And if you think about the prospect of starting a performance at 9 p.m., which we do in the early part of the season, that, you know, you wouldn't be finishing the performance before, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh.
It gets into matters of
that'd be fun.
Orchestra overtime and right. all kinds of things, union rules and what have you. I'm a big Wagner fan, and I would love to see a way for us to expand our repertory in terms of Wagner. The Santa Fe Opera has only done The Flying Dutchman on 2 occasions, but who knows? That might be a new frontier.
So you grew up here. Now you're back. What's it like to be back? Was this always your dream? I mean, when you were there, you were a pit boy and a French horn player and then a young bookkeeper and so on. Did you envision yourself in this role?
I never did. I was always grateful for the opportunity of working at the Santa Fe Opera, and I could never get enough of it. But when I observed first John Crosby and then Richard Gaddis, I never for a moment imagined that I would be following in their footsteps.
I bet they did.
Well, I think perhaps they did. I think John Crosby may have picked up on the fact that here's this kid who is just so driven and so absorbed with opera and so eager to learn and to know how do I get to the next level? Is there something else that I can learn, something else that I can do? That he gave me so many opportunities. And I think on some level he must have recognized potential there. When I consider my own experiences and the incredible opportunities that I had here, it makes me so mindful that we have to be providing those kinds of opportunities for gifted young people in all phases of opera. And that is one of the beautiful things about the Santa Fe Opera, is it's a great kind of laboratory and learning environment for young people coming into this field, to come for an intensive festival season and to work with the greatest people in the field and to be part of this wonderful enterprise. And also, you think about the kids who are attending performances. Next week, for example, we have the two first youth opera performances. I can't wait to stand at the back of the theater on those nights and to look into the auditorium and think, who knows, maybe there's a future general director in the audience tonight.
As you were when you were 9 years old.
That's right.
That's so interesting. Everybody knows about the apprentice program, but you've also got young people, college students or young adults who are doing every level of backstage stuff and administrative stuff as well.
That's right. And, you know, so many of the skills that are required in opera, lighting, scenery, costumes, all of those kind of nuts and bolts kind of thing, are transferable to other performing arts,
right,
or even to kind of commercial applications. And the fact that opera combines all of the arts into one package makes it a perfect opportunity for, someone who might be intent upon becoming a costume designer to also learn, what's going on with the scenic element, what's happening in terms of the musical side of opera, and so forth. And to the extent that we can, to provide seminar-type opportunities for these young people to meet with some of the important guest artists that we have here, and to really ask them, how did you get started? How what is the next step for me as I start to build my portfolio and to embark on my career? And this is just a great, great setting for that.
We're talking to Charles McKay, General Director of the Santa Fe Opera. We're going to go out with a piece of music that you have chosen. Tell us what it is.
This is Natalie Dessay singing Sempre Libera, the famous cabaletta, we call it, from the first act of La Traviata. Sempre Libera is a signature piece for soprano, and it will be a great way for us to begin our new season at the Santa Fe Opera, as sung by Natalie Dessay.
Sempre libera, di pieno colle cave, di gioia in gioia, o che storo per mia, e sentire il piacere, lo spento movimento mo muoia, sempre libera, e libera.
That was Natalie Dessay from La Traviata, which opens a week from tomorrow at the Santa Fe Opera. Charles McKay, General Director, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
And we'll see you all summer at the opera. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 505-428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and then jazz.